This is The Interchange Recharged, a Wood Mackenzie production. I'm David Banmiller. In the UK, the collaboration between banks and policymakers is crucial for accelerating the energy transition. The financial sector in the UK managed assets worth over £9 trillion as of 2020, with a considerable portion needing realignment towards sustainable investments to meet the 2050 net zero goal. The Climate Change Committee, an independent advisory board to the UK government, estimates £50 billion or $60 billion per year is needed to meet net zero goals. This covers investments across various sectors, including power generation, building upgrades, transportation, and industry. Heather Buchanan is co-founder of Bankers for Net Zero.
We really look specifically through the lens of the bank's commitments to decarbonize their financed emissions by 2050.
Bankers for Net Zero is an initiative involving banks and stakeholders who directly work with policymakers to align financial practices with the UK's net zero targets. Their efforts focus on policy recommendations that facilitate investment in green technologies and infrastructure. This collaborative approach ensures that the financial policies support and accelerate the necessary transitions in the energy sector. Heather, thanks for joining us.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you.
So we've talked a lot on this podcast about the need to get the financial community involved in the energy transition. So I was really excited to hear about your organization, Bankers for Net Zero. So can you tell me a little bit about what you guys do and some of the initiatives you're working on?
No, certainly. So Bankers for Net Zero, we're just over 5 years old now. We were actually formed just in the lead up to COP26. And originally, we were going to be a one-year, one-off project. And obviously, 1 year turned into 2 years because of COVID. And during that time, we were, you know, very involved with the Cabinet Office here and really looking at what it was going to mean as financial institutions came under increasing pressure to decarbonize their balance sheets and clean up those balance sheets, what that was going to look like in terms of policy on the ground and interaction with customers as new things were coming. So we convened the UK country chapter of the Net Zero Banking Alliance, and we really look specifically through the lens of the bank's commitments to decarbonize their financed emissions by 2050 and look at, you know, what are the main blockers to that, not just in terms of financial policy, but in terms of policy across the economy, because ultimately finance and banks touch everything in the economy. So, you know, where are the blockers there? And then critically, where are the enablers so that actually finance can really play its full potential within that process?
Now, I got to imagine bringing regulators, policymakers, financial institutions together can be quite challenging. What are some of the obstacles you guys have faced as you go through this?
Initially, particularly in the beginning, I think that a lot of kind of institutions were, you know, everybody kind of felt like they could almost create their own path and almost identify competitive opportunities within it. Over the kind of course of the years, obviously, people have come to the realization this is much bigger than any single organization or government, as the case is. And so I often joke that a great deal of my job is just connecting dots and herding cats and trying to kind of get everybody in the same room together. But as with anything, once we've gotten that momentum, we now really do have, you know, the majority of the financial services industry on board. And critically for us, it's not just financial services that are the kind of key players within this. We also bring together the civil society and NGOs. So we've got the likes of WWF and E3G in the room. Likewise, academia, and then, of course, the policymakers within that as well, and other parts of industry. So we get our large consultancy firms involved on our retrofit work stream. We speak to building firms and, you know, small business representatives, that entire ecosystem, and really try to kind of look down and find, you know, where the places of industry can do things on a voluntary level to help get things moving. And then where do we think there are some maybe regulatory things that can be unlocked without potential primary legislation? And then what are the really, you know, kind of bigger picture pieces where it's clear that there's going to need to be significant government intervention in terms of getting the market moving?
It's obviously a broad landscape of the various areas that these teams can get involved in. So where are you guys focused your attention, at least initially or right now?
Interestingly enough, it wasn't the oil and gas sector. You know, a lot of people would assume that oil, gas, transport would be the first things, but actually that's where you're dealing with much larger kind of multinationals and a lot of work's already been done. The really kind of tough stuff that particularly kind of retail banks are having to deal with are the retrofit. You know, we've got a very old housing stock in the UK and a very inefficient housing stock. And I think what people really don't potentially appreciate is when that very little line in the commitments that where banks say that they've committed to decarbonising their financed emissions by 2050, actually means that they're on the hook for every single mortgage that they write, every overdraft if they've got security on that, every small business loan, every corporate loan, and the corporate's entire supply chain. And so banks need to understand the assets that they've financed in a completely different way than they previously have. And a lot of that data doesn't necessarily exist, or if it doesn't exist in a way that is really kind of financial grade information. So there's some really, really kind of basic data challenges that need to be overcome in that. And certainly, I think the housing issue and the retrofit issue is probably one of the biggest ones, because, of course, it's an area where there needs to be significant policy intervention in order to, and of course, there's different types. You know, there's private rented accommodation, social housing, rented accommodation, owner occupiers, all of the different student housing, all these different kind of metrics together, and how you incentivize that, what is often, you know, quite a large capital expenditure and disruption, particularly to people's lives when we're talking about people's homes, is a tough nut to crack, as it were. And just offering a wee bit off a mortgage for doing some work just doesn't stack up for most people. So this is an area where I think that we've really had to kind of dig deep. And one of the things we're working on right now is even just getting the measurement right so that we can really unlock kind of finance to help these things go, because we don't have a system in place for that right now that's sufficient for what we need.
Yeah. So what is in the UK the current status of policy as it relates to retrofit?
So it's quite fragmented. We've had some recent interventions that have not been spectacularly successful, I would say. And so there is a level of almost a lack of trust between some of the interventions the government has done versus how those actually get executed on the ground, how funding flows, how the support goes. We have a significant skill shortage as well that will need to be addressed. And so, you know, whilst that's a challenge, of course, it's also a massive opportunity in terms of employment. But really, in order to really get the money flowing into the system, we need to have better measurement. We are working, as you say, on the energy performance certificate reform quite actively with government right now. But ultimately, it's kind of getting to a point where we have to understand that this is going to be a series of multiple interventions that is required. And up to now, I think we tend to have more kind of one-off things, you know, some support for a heat pump, some support for insulation. But the scale that we need to kind of address this is quite significant. So I think there's a huge challenge there, but also quite a big opportunity. And critically, I mean, one thing that's been really interesting to watch since COP26, really, when the first commitments were made by financial institutions, you now do have a finance industry that's very interested in these challenges and interested in ways to help, you know, move that along. So there's one thing I've definitely heard from the finance industry. It's not that the money's not there, but getting the incentives aligned along the way and getting the will for people to actually undertake the work is more of a significant challenge.
And how do you work on those incentives? Because like you were talking about, it's very fragmented, right? And so to hit the targets that we have set, it needs to be a lot more aggressive. And it's just piecemeal. Like I said, a little bit here, a little bit there. And there needs to be a more broad initiative.
Yeah.
It can't be all-encompassing, right? But that's a little bit more wholesome to drive this forward. So, I mean, from a financial incentive standpoint, what would you recommend or what do you think needs to be done?
So we have made some progress in that we've got the National Retrofit Hub that was set up last year, which really has brought together, and we co-convene one of the finance working group on that. And that is very much focused on everything from skills development to materials development. I mean, it hits everything. It's very focused on the practical implementation on the ground in terms of actually really getting the finance unlocked. So energy EPC reform, as you know, financial grade information is absolutely critical in order to kind of bring the cost of finance down, to de-risk, to actually understand the progress you're making in terms of decarbonization with an asset. The way that it's structured right now, I mean, EPCs were never meant to be measurement tools in the first instance, and they certainly weren't meant to be financial measurement tools. They're the only thing out there. And so the fact that those are kind of being used within financial structures just doesn't make sense. So getting the measurements right, first and foremost, is kind of your basic. I think there's probably a lot more that we can do with the insurance industry in this area. And also in terms of businesses, obviously looking at the tax structures and tax incentives in terms of capital allowances. And then for the kind of larger market, the opportunities for either using blended finance, so where government can take, you know, potentially a small slice of risk to help free up some of the capital, particularly for small businesses, and looking at things like property linked finance, which we don't really have here. So I always think of, you know, the first time my husband and I bought our flat, we had about 32 pence in the bank account by the time you'd paid all the fees and moved in and you had your one piece of furniture as a young couple without, you know, just about to start a family and all that. And you don't expect to stay in that property for a long time. It's not going to be your forever home. So there's absolutely nothing that would have convinced us that it was a good idea to do some kind of full energy retrofit of the building with the 10p that we had in the bank account anyway. So that just wasn't a priority and it wasn't a place that we were going to stay. So having things like property linked finance where that money can become available for somebody, you know, moving in, you make the house a better place, but that debt kind of stays with the property and gets paid back at an incredibly low interest rate over a number of years. So it means that yes, there's still maybe 20 or 30,000 pounds of debt sitting with the property and it gets passed on to the next occupants, but just gets paid back through property taxes. So how do we de-risk things by taking out those really kind of high upfront capital costs? It has got to be something we need to look at in terms of financial incentives.
I was actually just going to ask you, how do you incentivize the homeowner, the business owner to upgrade in this way? Because even if you have low cost financing, it's still cash and money out of their pocket. And so what really drives them, besides being interested and supportive of the energy transition, what else can happen to really get them to take that on?
I guess this is where some of the kind of carrot and stick element comes in, and some of it's a stick, as we well know. We've been playing with, again, but based on EPCs, which is not necessarily the right measurement, you know, looking at new homes have to be built to a certain standard. That's the easy bit. But, you know, there are questions, and this is what's interesting in the UK, of course, is that each of the devolved nations can have different housing policies. So you had a housing policy in Scotland, it's different than in Wales, it's different than England and Northern Ireland. And so you can find different jurisdictions being more ambitious than others. But I think there's big points in life, isn't there, in terms of when you're buying a house or when you're selling a house. I think one of the areas of opportunity is when somebody has bought a place. I don't think it makes sense necessarily to put the onus on the seller of a house. But creating incentives at purchase point is certainly an area, I think, that creates a lot of opportunities because often you're doing work anyway, or there's that period of time before you move in and something like that. So again, linking things up with property linked finance so it isn't necessarily, it might be a bit of bother, but isn't necessarily cash out, are probably one of our bigger opportunity points. Of course, though, you know, that doesn't necessarily help with those that are already in their homes. And, you know, this is where I always declare an interest because I can talk a lot about retrofits and financing retrofits, but I live in a very drafty, uninsulated, single glazed, you know, a house in Scotland with a few internal water features, which were not planned. And I can look around my own home and you know, I can talk about this on podcasts and I can talk about the financing, but I look around my own home and say, well, actually, we can't afford to do the work that needs to get done on it. And the disruption that comes around with it, because it's significant in its 1851 old Scottish farmhouse, it is a big challenge. So I think this is where the government intervention becomes so important in these places in order to either provide the tax breaks. You know, there's no VAT on new build houses, but you have to pay VAT at 20% on building works like that. So reducing VAT and trying to reduce that capital burden in the first instance is obviously front and center of everybody's mind. And even with increasing energy costs and everything else, it's still having the wherewithal to stump up the cash in the first instance is significant.
And the property linked finance, I mean, that broadens it out to community wide versus just the house down the street. And that just grows the adoption from there. You know, you mentioned the blended finance. What are some other examples of the blended finance that's working at the moment?
A perfect example, and not necessarily in the retrofit space, I guess, but is the COVID loan schemes, recovery loan schemes, all of these things. Because ultimately, what you're doing is reducing the amount of capital that the banks need to hold. And doing that means that they can be more competitive with their rates and they want to move the money there. And so you kind of, I think, create a lot of competition in the market for that. But clearly, on the other side of it, you need to have the demand. And I think that's one of the bigger problems within the sector now is the demand side. When we speak to banks and talk about green mortgages and whatnot, everybody's got a green mortgage product and say, that's fantastic. They say, but the actual demand really isn't there at the level that we need it to be to move. And so I do see this area as not so much a financing problem as an overall policy and incentive issue, because it's disruptive. It's disruptive to everybody's life. And there's not necessarily an easy answer to it, unfortunately.
It's an exciting time for solar. Advancements in tech, policy support, investment, and the decentralization of solar promise a bright future for the industry. Tax credits are driving investment, and large projects across many U.S. states are grabbing headlines. On The Interchange, we dive deep into the technology and financing that's driving solar growth. We've been joined by industry leaders and experts on the show over the past couple years, and we're back this year to do it again. We'll be in San Francisco on the 12th and 13th of June at Wood Mackenzie's Solar and Energy Storage Summit. As always, I'll be bringing you the debates, conversations, and insights from the industry's leading event right here on the podcast. To secure your ticket, visit woodmac.com/events and subscribe to The Interchange so you don't miss the special episodes coming in June. Look forward to seeing you there. We've talked a lot with a number of guests on financing the energy transition. And from the financial partners that I've spoken to, they've all said basically the same thing. The money is there, right? The money is available. Now, maybe not to the level of the full energy transition, right? We still need to work on that because those are big dollars. But to at least get started and make significant progress, the financing is there. It's just the other side that needs to come together and get coordinated. And as you said, not be piecemeal and really have a meeting of the minds between the regulators, policymakers, and financial institutions to make an impact.
Absolutely. And I mean, there's some interesting kind of retrofit kind of social housing demonstrator projects that are going on, you know, across the countries. And this is the other thing, as a lot of this, you need kind of the consent of communities, particularly if you're going to be doing things on a larger scale. So working in a more kind of place-based format. But this is where I do think that we've got the opportunity to be more ambitious, but it does take a level of coordination. You know, it's not just deals anymore. You know what I mean? Like finance is like a developer and a finance person, you put together a deal. This is a wider scope now, and there's a new way of kind of engaging with policy, where what I always kind of say to our financial institutions is, you know, how do we de-risk some of these bigger policy decisions for politicians? They've got their own kind of risk profiles, you know, it's not necessarily on a spreadsheet like this within an institution, but they've got their own constituency bases and whatnot that they need to deal with. And so how do we say, well, actually, if you do go for these kind of bigger, bolder policy decisions, you know, there's a bit of a pact there that needs to say, well, if it's designed like this, we can come in and support it and execute it and it'll work for us. Whereas policymaking historically has been everybody puts forward their side of the story, as it were, and then policy comes up with something. And I think we need to get more nuance with that to really get to those next stages and make some of the kind of bigger collaborative bits of work that need to get done.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, the policymakers are beholden to their constituents. And so they need to be able to sell initiatives to them, because sometimes they're either afraid to make decisions because they're politicians. But if you can deliver a package to the constituents and say, hey, here's what you get, I think it's a lot more feasible to drive it forward.
Absolutely. And it's interesting, particularly as we know in this kind of energy efficiency area, we all know that the benefits of living in warmer, drier homes, the health co-benefits, everything else that goes with it, it all makes sense. And, you know, it's nice not to have to kind of put on six jumpers every night if you're trying to, you know, when you're watching the telly rather than turning the heat on. But the fear of who's going to pay for this and how that money is, where the burden is going to lie, is significant in a lot of communities. And so, again, putting those packages together in a way that allows for the benefits without putting that undue burden on is quite difficult. One, it's a difficult balance, obviously, and the balance between those that definitely cannot afford to pay it, those that are able to pay, X, Y, and Z.
Now, you mentioned EPC, and wanted to ask you about EPC reform. I mean, why is that important, and how can you go about accomplishing that?
So ultimately, if you think when you're doing your mortgage application, your finance application, you've got income expenditure, you know, all the numbers that stack up to your bottom line. We've never really had to count carbon within that mortgage application or anything. And now we do. EPC reform now, just because of the way that it works, it can be much more of an opinion-based process than we'd like. But also you hear of stories where an EPC rating can go down when you install a heat pump because of the cost implications, which actually goes back to the way that, you know, electricity tax is different than gas tax. So being able to, from a financial perspective, being able to understand what a property is operating at a certain level. And this is, you know, it's not simple because you also need to be able to extract, you know, what's the condition of the property, what's its potential in terms of its energy, you know, versus energy usage of the occupants and stuff. But if you're able to have much more precise measurements of energy consumption and track that, you know, so before and after works, it then means that you can start assuring some of the stuff that you're doing. And the way that EPCs are right now is they're far too vague for really sophisticated financing. And of course, the more accurate something is, the lower the risk, the lower the risk, the lower the cost. So it becomes quite a simple equation in that. And just from a building's perspective, in particular, having the historical kind of buildings that we do here in the UK, I remember speaking with an architect at an event once who dealt with kind of some of the most, you know, extraordinary listed buildings that we've got in London. And I remember him saying to me that EPCs were like kryptonite to kind of older heritage buildings as well, and often drove some of the wrong behaviors. So getting more nuanced so that we're not only working on the financing, but also working proportionately and in the best way possible for our built environment and for our built heritage as well is critical.
That gets back to your earlier point about the importance of data in relation to this, because, or the accuracy of data rather, because coming from a banking background, vagueness is viewed as risk. Right. Unless you can be crystal clear on things, you apply the risk premium to it. And we're trying to eliminate all of that with the transition.
Absolutely. But I mean, this is the difficulty, isn't it? Because on the one hand, we want to eliminate the risk. And then on the other hand, we're flying the plane as we build it. And we're having to move at a pace that is potentially, you know, not as comfortable for, particularly for kind of risk averse large institutions. And again, this is where kind of, you know, the role that potentially that the insurance industry or the blended finance and government can come in to kind of help facilitate some of that and make sure that that risk premium doesn't stay too high and make things unworkable.
I mean, with your discussions with the various counterparts with this initiative, I mean, how have the talks been around balancing energy security with the costs as we drive towards net zero? I mean, what has been some of the feedback, questions, concerns that you've heard?
So it's interesting, actually, because energy security is obviously, you know, particularly over the last couple of years, has come front and center of people's minds. And I think everybody understands that, you know, having renewable energy, warmer homes, all of these things all build to that. But I think the problem still sits in that perception of what the amount of work it's going to take to get there. And I think we undersell it. I think we undersell the opportunity that will come in terms, you know, not just for, you know, the co-benefits of living in nicer buildings, but in terms of the opportunities of job creation. I mean, there's, you know, a serious skill shortage here, but that means, you know, new opportunities for jobs. But, you know, it doesn't help that all of this gets politicized and starts to become a bit of a political football as well. But I do think that we tend to look on the glass half empty side of things in the political discourse rather than leaning into the opportunity that it can provide. And I think that's something that is everybody's, I guess, responsibility in terms of, you know, there's obviously government messaging to do, but also within institutions and organizations trying to find that and really portray the positive opportunity that comes from this.
The opportunity is tremendous. Just look at the required infrastructure build out as part of the transition. It's tremendous. And I think that's something that's not fully appreciated across the globe is how much is needed. And you're right, that's going to be job creation. I mean, we had an episode not too long ago with somebody from the IEA talking about the workforce and specialized in the energy transition. And you had mentioned earlier the lack of skill sets associated with the transition. I mean, that's something that's across the board. I mean, you can talk about all the different areas where that's going to impact this initiative. So there's a lot of opportunity, particularly for the younger generations to be educated in this and really make an impact from an economic standpoint.
No, absolutely. And I mean, one of the other main work streams that we've been working on, which kind of feeds into this quite a bit, is of course the role of SMEs within this. And again, it's one of those areas where, because it's a fragmented, you know, SME is, as we know, everything from your kind of sole traders up can be quite fragmented, but the cumulative opportunity within that, not only in terms of the solutions that new SMEs can provide for these things, but also the cumulative effect of SMEs kind of acting in cohort is quite strong. And so again, how do we harness that in a way that creates an opportunity? And a lot of it in the first and foremost will be in the fabric of their buildings. So, you know, again, we go back to retrofits within that process.
And that could make a significant impact, given the SMEs are the majority out there, right? And so getting them on board and giving initiatives that are more broad-based blanket approaches is just going to make a wider and more significant and faster impact.
Absolutely. Certainly in the UK, you know, 97% of businesses are SMEs, and I think about 44% are micro businesses. So being able to engage at that kind of mass level is really important. This is where, though, we think that financial institutions have a unique opportunity, because whilst everybody says that SMEs have nothing in common, we always say, well, actually, they've got two things in common. They've got to do their taxes and they'll have a way to move their money. And so those both become quite important tools in either, you know, communicating or providing opportunities for incentives for kind of engaging in that process. And likewise, SMEs, just like homeowners, are going to need to engage with their financial institutions with levels of data that previously were not required, and you're back to kind of carbon data and impact data. And I think that's going to be an interesting learning curve over the next few years.
What are some of the other areas that banks can work to help reduce scope 3 emissions? Right. I mean, we've got scope 1, 2, 3. We talk about different ways to calculate it. But what are some of the initiatives that the banks can do to help drive that?
So it's interesting because banks, they'll have their different levels of scope 3 emissions, you know. I mean, so there's that kind of bank to corporate level, but then making sure there's that consistency in how the corporates engage with their entire supply chain. And like one of the interesting things here is making sure that we've got that consistency where when banks are asking for information from their SMEs, it's consistent with what other corporates are asking. So SMEs, again, are getting a lot of the brunt of lots of different types of questions from different areas. But what we're seeing with financial institutions right now is working a lot with carbon calculators, getting those integrated as free services within their bank accounts. There's quite a few tools out there in terms of initial measurement for based on spend-based analysis. It's not perfect, but it's a good start. And again, we're working with some projects to kind of get that data much more granular. But ultimately, there's a more kind of joining up. And I think it's not just the banks, it'll be the banks, but also the accountants. So we work quite closely with the accountancy bodies, because particularly with SMEs, you know, the first professional they'll hire is their accountant, the bookkeeper. But the tools that can come via your bank account, particularly in this digital age, a great way to either start the measurement journey or signpost to new areas. And I think that's where we're seeing certainly our financial services members really interested in how they can engage more collaboratively with their customers. And it provides opportunities for them as well, of course.
What kind of changes to GHG protocols do you think would make big impacts?
In general, this whole process of our GHG protocols, our emissions reporting, everything has been a very top-down process up to now. And I think that we need to take a step back, and rather than the kind of gold-plated reporting that we've done for corporates, almost step back and say, if you're a consumer, if you're a small business, what are the actual information that we really need? What are the few data points that we actually need, and how we can make those actionable? It's just too complicated right now. You know, go to conferences, as you know, every day of the year talking about different sustainability things. And I mean, for most people, it's not even like learning a different language. It's like Klingon, isn't it? Like everybody speaks in acronyms, and we need to break this down to a much simpler kind of bottom-up approach where, you know, you can get what's the data you actually need? How do we get to points where products have, you know, traffic lights, you know, systems that are very much like we now know how to read our food labels for calories and whatnot. And I think until we get a lot more consistency and a lot more simplification and clarity through kind of the general messaging, we're going to be going in circles for quite a while.
So kind of on the data collection topic, tell us a little bit about Project Perseus.
So Project Perseus is a project that we started just over a year ago. We're involved with another not-for-profit organization called Icebreaker One. And it's essentially using the principles of open banking. You know, so you get a little pop-up and you want to share your financial data from A to B. But doing that to collect electricity data in the first instance. And it means it's not a database. It's not a platform. It's essentially creating the right rules and trust where you can share primary data from the energy company to, whether it's your bank account, to a carbon calculator, with the permission of the customer. And the customer kind of retains control of their information. And the aspiration within that is, of course, is that rather than these kind of onerous 25-page documents that everyone has to fill out around their energy consumption with a pop-up, do you want to share your data? Yes. With whom do you want to share it with? There we go. And it happens. And it means that the data is then assurable as well. So it becomes auditable, which is not the process or the case right now. As I said, we're starting with one data point, kind of building the rails for the project. The plan is to go on to other data points in the future. But really, and again, this goes back to the kind of majority of the population, this could work as much for a consumer as it could for a small business, as it could for a large business. But how do we automate and make a lot of this data collection as simple as possible, so that then we can make the data work for us rather than working to get the data so much. We can make the data work for us and, you know, then start doing the things that need to be done because you can start to measure it. And we're really excited. We've got all of the major trade bodies in the UK involved. The plan is that we are going to be piloting it in the UK, but we also have a really large contingent of international observers, such as the OECD and the World Energy Council, International Chambers of Commerce, etc., who are going along on that journey with us, as well as standards bodies like CDP and the ISSB and PCAF and others. So it is a real opportunity to start getting that real granular supply chain data into the system in a way that's truly scalable. And that just doesn't exist right now.
Well, that's great to hear. I mean, given the critical role that data is going to play in the energy transition, making it accurate, easy and reliable is going to be very important.
Absolutely. And I think that it sounds so simple, doesn't it? So many times I go, actually, we're just trying to get electricity data from a smart meter from A to B in a way that's assurable. And most people are like, well, doesn't that exist? And so, well, actually, and because we've got government and regulators on board with us, it means that if, you know, as we've come up with barriers, we've been able to kind of unlock them as we go. But actually, legally speaking, it was much harder to share energy data than it has been to share financial data. And obviously, each data point is going to have its own bits. And then even rolling this out internationally, it will still be jurisdiction by jurisdiction because of, you know, data laws. But like open banking, which is now in, you know, over 60 countries worldwide, we've got the model that's in. It's been a very successful model to work on. So we're very much looking at replicating that. And the team that we work with were the ones that designed and implemented open banking. So we're in good hands.
So now going back to the beginning of our conversation about the Herculean effort of bringing all parties together from policymakers, regulators, financiers, all that, how positive do you feel about the impact that you've made or the progress that you've made thus far?
Very positive. Now, having said that, I'm a pathological optimist, so which I think you probably have to be within this within this space. But we have really seen that need for engagement and that willingness for engagement grow. And we've got just an extraordinary number of really dedicated and fantastic people trying to work through these issues. And for the most part, everybody, you know, is very happy to work together on them. It's always going to be difficult, you know, when you're working with institutions that are sometimes larger than countries, working, you know, even within a single jurisdiction in a country that's got, you know, four separate devolved nations within that and all the policy kind of intricacies there, and trying to pull that together is always going to be a difficult process. But we definitely have momentum on our side on this one and a real kind of genuine willingness from everybody to make it work. And that's obviously an important bit. I think we have been fortunate in the UK, whilst we haven't escaped it completely, the whole energy transition piece is not too politicized, not to say that it's not at all, but it's not as politicized as other jurisdictions. So we are fortunate in that sense. And there's that general acknowledgement, and it's, you know, it's written into law, that we do need to get to net zero by 2050. And we spent a lot of time kind of just figuring out where we are. And I think that work has mostly been done now. And now it's a matter of how to make it happen and how to make it happen quickly, because we definitely aren't there yet.
Well, Heather, thanks for joining us on the show today. And I wish you the best of luck on herding those beastly cats that you've got to do.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
The Interchange is a Wood Mackenzie production. We'll be releasing the show every second Tuesday, so mark your diaries and subscribe so you don't miss an episode. I'm David Bandmiller. It's been a pleasure joining you. See you next time.